From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we are rebroadcasting our special hour on video games. Seemingly in celebration of the occasion, the Supreme Court, a huge OTM fan, struck down a California law that would have levied fines against retailers who sold violent games to minors. That happened on Monday. Speaking for the court, Justice Antonin Scalia wrote that the basic principles of freedom of speech do not vary with a new and different communications medium. Maybe you think video games are mostly about murder and mayhem. Judging by sales, probably they are. But they're also about blazing new trails in technology and art. And I assure you, they are changing how you live, whether or not you play. After this hour, you'll know why. But first, some history. That starts, says New York Times Magazine writer and game aficionado Clive Thompson, with a simple tennis game invented by Atari co-founder Nolan Bushnell called Pong.
He put it in this thing called Andy Capp's Saloon in a bar, and he got a call a day later saying, the machine's broken, come fix it. And what had happened was that so many quarters were jammed in the slot, it was stuck. He knew right away, wow, this is clearly a compelling activity for people to do. It was the first time that the average person sat down and used some sort of controls, in this case a little spinning knob, to affect what was happening on the screen and to have a kind of a meaningful and fun experience. You got to remember...
Meaningful?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. I mean, in the sense that any game is meaningful. You know, it's part of how we challenge ourselves, we challenge other people. And it illustrated something that computers can do really well, which is to let people sort of play with physics. Because that's all Pong was. Like, wow, if I try and put some real English on this ball, what do I get? And that was something that was very common in those early video games. Pac-Man and Space Invaders and Pong were almost like looking directly into the soul of the machine. Those games are what computers think about when we're not around, basically.
We always say that arcade games came first, but I would argue that the home game actually preceded the arcade game if you count Winky Dink. That was a TV show that debuted in October of 1953.
Winky Dink. And you, Winky Dink, and me always have the last.
What you do is you place a clear piece of plastic that came in a kid across the TV screen, and you connected the dots to create a bridge for this character, Winky Dink, to cross to safety. So that not only makes Winky Dink the first video game, but the first interactive video game, and it started in your house.
Winky Dink was like, wow, you know, this thing is in our house. It's kind of uncanny. It's got these moving pictures on it. What happened if we touched it? You couldn't actually affect what was happening on the screen. If you drew the bridge incorrectly, the character would not fall, right? And so the next step was really for the video game to come along and say, you're going to interact with what's on screen, and it's going to change based on what you do. I think this is what trained us for the explosion of computers in our everyday lives.
Right, and what enabled us to be comfortable with doing that? The mouse.
People forget this, but the mouse was an incredibly complicated thing for people to wrap their heads around when it first came out. It really did feel like there was this disembodied thing happening because you're not looking at your hands off to one side and you're moving it and this little pointer's moving on screen. That's so normal to us now, but the first time anyone does it, it's very, very weird and unsettling and actually hard. And so one of the smartest things that Microsoft ever did, they put Solitaire on all versions of Windows. And it sort of trained them in how to use the mouse because they would click and drag a card over and lift the button up. Once you mastered using the mouse as Solitaire, you were ready to go on to use things like word processors and spreadsheets. I cannot tell you how many people I've talked to that have said that's what got them past the hump back in the early 80s. The mouse completely flustered them. They played Solitaire for 5 hours and bang, they were in there with the machine.
Also in the 1980s, we saw Nintendo create the famous Game Boy. Did you have one?
I did. I remember when I got it, I was so excited because there was this idea that, wow, I can play these games anywhere now. You know, I don't have to be in front of a TV. It had a little screen. It had sound. When you look back at it now, what's amazing is this is the first time ever that a lot of people, again, mostly young boys, although a lot of young girls too, were carrying around a personal computer with them all day long. I mean, now, of course, we think that's completely normal. We have phones that are functional computers. We have iPads, laptops. But the first time in history that the average person just walked around with something that had a screen and really fast processing was the Game Boy. When computers first came along, they were these important work machines, right? All they had to do was display black and white text and spreadsheets, and that's all the serious businessman needed. The first person that ever came along and said, no, there should be pretty pictures on screen, was the game makers. And so they went off and they basically built this huge billion-dollar industry trying to put beautiful pictures on screens. And then eventually the business people go, oh, wow, of course we need better ways to visualize our data. Thank you, video game industry, for inventing this for us. So if you don't have any Game Boy forcing screen makers to make better and better screens every year, finally they have color and they have backlighting and they have better resolution, you don't get the iPhone in the long run. The video game industry absolutely laid the seedbed for all the ways that we interact with data on screen right now.
It started in the arcade, then it landed in your hand. Contemporaneous with that, you had at least solitaire on your home computer. Then, in the early 90s, id Software popularized the infamous category of video games called first-person shooters. Not until id brought out Wolfenstein and Doom did they really catch on.
That's right. Instead of looking down on the action, you were in a first-person perspective. You were looking at things that looked to be 3D. You were looking down a hallway. You would move down the hallway. The halls would move past you.
Would you play with me right now?
Sure, let's go play.
I haven't played this for a little while.
Previous games would make you feel very engaged, but this is the one that really made you feel, wow, I'm literally in this sort of almost Tron-like way inside the game itself. Obviously, that laid the bed for a lot of games that become increasingly immersive, where you're physically inside these beautiful worlds that can really feel like genuine alternate realities.
So, Clive, I wish that I could focus entirely on what you were saying. I'm busy killing Nazis. Somebody's shooting at me, but where? Where are they?
So I think the thing that these 3D games did has almost not even yet come to fruition in terms of its real impact. I would not be shocked if 10 years from now you've got glasses and heads-up displays. This idea that the world can have a 3D layer on top of it is going to become a very, very interesting thing. And it's going to be very familiar to people that spent their lives at that point in time growing up playing 3D immersive worlds where they ran around inside data, basically. Oh, I just got killed. My health went down to zero.
Let's go back to the studio.
I noticed, by the way, that you were really good at playing Wolfenstein. And had you ever played it before?
No, never.
So this is exactly what I'm talking about. You know, if you tried playing it back then, you would have been horrible at it. But you've spent the intervening 20 years interacting with things that are essentially the children of video games. And so you've absorbed some good video game skills without even playing video games.
What was once a solitary enterprise that may have begun with solitaire becomes World of Warcraft, a massive cultural exchange across nations and across time.
Absolutely. When you go into World of Warcraft, everyone you see, most of the people, are real people, and they could be anywhere. I was on a reporting trip to China. I went into an internet cafe, and I saw these young Chinese soldiers in their uniforms, off duty, playing World of Warcraft, and they're wandering around in areas that I had been just myself about a week earlier. And I'm like, wow, I wonder if I ran into some of these Chinese soldiers when I was there last time. They form teams so that they can do even more audacious quests.
They can speak to each other.
They can speak to each other with voice or with text. The other thing that is really interesting about World of Warcraft is that you've got a meter that shows how strong you are, you've got a meter that shows what your next mission is, you've got a map showing where you're oriented, you've got a chat stream showing what other players are saying. There's an unbelievable amount of things you have to manage, and often in the heat of battle. But they make it really easy to do. Every tool is sort of around the edges of the screen, and it's very good at giving you little ambient cues, little dings and bits of noise to let you know when something is happening. So you really feel in control. And this is really one of the other things that video games have pioneered, which is how to put someone in a situation where they have an unbelievable amount of information and they have to manage it, and how to do it in a calm, graceful way. There's a lot of software over the last 10 years that has slowly been catching up to video games. If you're using a Mac, you'll notice that if you get a new instant message, your little icon on the bottom of the screen will just bounce up and down. Just very calmly letting you know, when you're free, go check your instant messaging. Someone is messaging you. That is absolutely a type of information disclosure that was pioneered and perfected by video games years before.
So if the decade of the aughts was managing huge amounts of data to create and build a world and maintain yourself within it, if that's what happened in the earlier part of this past decade, What accounts for what's happened in the latter part of it? I'm talking about going beyond mice or joysticks to our whole bodies with the Wii or the new Microsoft Kinect.
The first company to do this was Nintendo with the Wii, where they basically said, you know, there's a certain generation of people that are never going to figure out these joysticks. These joysticks have like 18 buttons on it. There's no way you're handing that to my mother. So they said, well, what if you just had to swing your hand, and when you swung your hand, you swung a tennis racket?
Love 15.
And they, with that very smart idea, created the Wii controller, which has a little motion sensor. And so that's exactly what you do. You swing your hand and the racket swings. And Microsoft recently took that further, where they basically have something that just sprays invisible rays across your room, senses where your body is, and it lets you just wave your arm or move your head or stand up and sit down to control the game. But a bunch of hackers have said, well, no, I want to run my email and I want to run my web browsing and I want to run my computer using that. So they started hacking it. And sure enough, they figured out how to get the Microsoft Kinect to let them control their computers just with a wave of their hands. Now you can immediately see what the future is going to look like, right? You could be just standing in the middle of your kitchen and bringing up your email or bringing up the menu with a wave of your hands onto a local screen. You saw Tom Cruise doing that a little bit in Minority Report. I used to think, well, that seems a little far-fetched. But as usual, I was betting against technology, which is a bad thing to bet against. And it looks like this stuff is going to be coming down the pike within 5 years, if you ask me.
Clive, thank you so much.
Not at all.
New York Times Magazine writer and techno whiz, Clive Thompson. Coming up, do you have to play to understand? Do you have to understand to play? Yes? Maybe? No. This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com with tools designed to help lawyers, doctors, and business professionals protect and improve their online reputations. More about controlling online reputations at Reputation.com. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting solutions to prevent and end homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need on the web at RWJF.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone with a cautionary tale about the business of games. This is the sound of compulsion, the drive to stack and pack various colored blocks as they rain down a digital screen. This is Tetris. Though it had been popular in arcades, even home screens, for years, it became an icon only when it came bundled with Nintendo's Game Boy in 1989. That's when Nintendo was riding high after having single-handedly revived the video game industry back in 1985. That was 2 years after video game giant Atari was caught secretly burying 14 truckloads of unsold games and consoles in a desert landfill in Alamogordo, New Mexico. Atari was trying to cover up dismal sales that were sinking the stock price of its parent company, Warner Communications. The video game business was dead. You see, anybody could make games for Atari's console, and every conceivable business did. But games are different from TV shows or movies or commercials, something those outsiders didn't understand. And so, as On the Media producer PJ Vogt explains, they killed the golden goose by stuffing it with ill-conceived, atrocious fare.
How atrocious? Well, there was Chase the Chuckwagon by Purina, the dog food company, or Picnic by Quaker Oats, where you had to protect your lunch from bugs. By 1985, the flood of bad games had shrunk the game industry's value from $3 billion down to just a few hundred million dollars. And that's when our story really starts. That winter, Nintendo sent out salespeople to try to pitch U.S. retailers on a new console that was doing really well in Japan. Video game historian Stephen Kent is the author of First Quarter.
Retailers weren't exactly excited to see them. One Nintendo salesman told me that he was afraid when he went to Sears Roebuck that they were going to march him out the door and beat him up in the parking lot.
Store owners had already been burned by unsold video games. Nintendo knew that it had better games and a better business model, but it had to trick retailers into stocking their system. So it came up with a Trojan horse. Nintendo bundled the video game system with an accessory, a robot toy named Rob.
Play with Rob. the extraordinary video robot.
The way they pitched it to retailers, Rob was a toy that just happened to come with a video game.
When they went to retailers, the retailers said, "We don't want video games." They'd say, "No, this isn't a video game. This is a robot game." And the retailers would say, "Oh, okay, robot games. As long as it's not video, we're happy." That was how they got in the door.
Once they started to get the video game system in the hands of kids, the cycle began.
David Sheff is the author of Game Over.
They went from having zero shares in an industry that was worthless to having 90% market share of an industry that grew to become a $1 billion, then a $2 billion, then a $3 billion, and then eventually a $5 and $6 billion industry.
Nintendo's game designers, led by Shigeru Miyamoto, fully grasped that they were creating a new medium. Their games were artful, imaginative, and addictive.
Mario was this plumber that was kind of pudgy and, you know, wore overalls, the last person you'd expect to be a hero in a video game. His brother Luigi, you know, another unlikely hero. They were just kind of two, you know, funny, dorky guys who went off on these great adventures. And it was so exciting to find flying turtles, mushrooms that you'd jump on that you could fly.
Each game evoked its own vivid world. You could play The Legend of Zelda as Link, an elfin warrior with a sword and a boomerang on a mission to save a princess. Or you could play Metroid as Samus, an intergalactic bounty hunter who removes his helmet in the game's last act, revealing that he was actually a she.
Maybe it sounds silly, but you know, at the time it was exciting because, you know, we really had identified with this character and there was this great surprise waiting.
Nintendo's games created demand for their console. And once people got their hands on the console, they wanted more games. More than Nintendo could create alone. Nintendo needed outside developers to help create games for them, but they were scared of repeating Atari's mistake, of letting the Purinas of the world ruin their market with bad games. Howard Lincoln, former chairman of Nintendo of America.
It was the failure of Atari to have any kind of quality control, not only over its own games, but also games by third-party companies. We had to come up with some kind of a solution.
The solution was a proprietary chip that Nintendo put in every game cartridge. Their system was designed to only play games with the chip inside them. To qualify for the chip, games had to first be awarded Nintendo's seal of quality. Stephen Kent.
The Nintendo seal of quality meant a lot of things. Basically, what it meant was that you gave Nintendo 10 bucks a cartridge for every cartridge that came out.
This was new. Before Nintendo, game hardware companies didn't typically profit from games that third-party developers designed for their hardware. The seal made Nintendo a lot of money, but it also made universal quality control possible. For Nintendo, that meant good, clean games. No violence or sex, no politics or religion. Once, an outside developer submitted a game featuring female villains. Stephen Kent.
Howard Lincoln called the head of this company in and said, "I've got a problem with this game. There's violence against women in it." And the guy said, "No, there's no violence against women in this game." And they started playing it for a few minutes, and out come these female gangsters who you punch them out and they fall down and disappear. And the president of the other company looked at him and said, "Oh, you mean the transvestites."
Game makers tolerated Nintendo's censorship because there was no alternative. From the mid-80s into the 90s, Nintendo completely dominated the U.S. home video game market. Their first successful competitor was another Japanese company called Sega. Sega hired an American, Tom Kalinske, to figure out how to beat Nintendo. Kalinske remembers traveling to Japan to convince Sega's board of his strategy. Through a translator, he told them that Sega would have to sell cheaper games, give third-party developers more freedom, and most crucially, cater to a more grown-up market.
I said, "Okay, guys, and we're going to go after teenagers and college-age kids. We'll leave Nintendo with the younger kids, and we're going to take on Nintendo in a very direct manner in our advertising." Of course, you know, everybody on the board started talking in Japanese. I didn't understand a word of it, and it went on for like an hour. And a guy was whispering in my ear every now and then, sort of trying to give me the gist of what different people were saying, and it was all bad.
In the end, the board actually took Kalinske's advice. Sega offered older gamers what Nintendo lacked: racier content, violence, and good sports games. In-your-face TV ads highlighted the strength of Sega's Genesis console.
Genesis does 16-bit sports action.
You can't do this on Nintendo.
A big coup for Sega was its adaptation of a ludicrously violent arcade game called Mortal Kombat. It was a martial arts game where players would fight each other to submission.
Are you ready?
And then, as Stephen Kent remembers,
once you subdued your opponent, you'd do these finishing moves where you'd pull a guy's skull and spine out of his body or other really bloody things. And Nintendo said, you know what? We don't want that on our game.
The home version of the game came out simultaneously, both on Sega's Genesis and on Nintendo's new console, the Super NES, but with a crucial difference. Howard Lincoln.
We ultimately decided that, no, the blood had to be green. But on the Sega version of Mortal Kombat, it was red.
Sega gobbled up market share. When Klinsky started in 1990, Sega held less than 8% of the market. By 1992, that number had grown to 55%. Meanwhile, Nintendo stuck to their original vision for games, the one that had revived a dead market in 1985, games that were G-rated, tightly controlled, and beautifully made. That stubbornness cost Nintendo, as first Sega, then Sony, then Microsoft, each took progressively more of Nintendo's market share. Today, Nintendo has rebounded on the strength of its Wii console, but the video game world has changed. No single giant dominates, and the big hardware companies just don't have the clout to dictate what content they'll allow on their consoles. This holiday season, the most popular video game in stores is one that never would have been approved by Nintendo execs back in the 80s or 90s. For starters, it came out on nearly every platform at once. Microsoft Xboxes, Nintendo Wiis, Sony PlayStations, and personal computers. It's called Call of Duty Black Ops, and it's a violent shoot-em-up game with political overtones. It's the latest installment in a franchise that's made its creators more than $3 billion so far. And it came from a developer named Activision, a company started by rogue programmers who'd abandoned a failing hardware company in the early 80s, a company called Atari.
The descendant of Atari's arcade game Pong is the wildly popular cell phone game Angry Birds, produced by the small Finnish company Rovio. With your finger, you pull back a slingshot holding a bird, calculate the angle, and catapult it into an increasingly elaborate array of structures sheltering evil pigs. I can't stop playing it. Maybe we're hardwired to send things flying in parabolas because cavemen did it to capture prey or something. I don't know. Jamin Brophy Warren, editor of the literary gaming magazine Killscreen, says we engage much more than we know with the work of game designers. But where he sees art, the mainstream media see toasters.
The words that are used to describe video games. Most major publications do not place video games in italics or quotation marks.
The titles of specific games.
The titles of specific games.
As they would with a novel.
They treat them like a Toyota Prius, right? We would never put a Prius in quotation marks. Or Windows Vista, right? And I think that that distinction is very important, and it changes the way that people think about video games. They think about them as technological product, as opposed to something that was created, that there were artists, and there was a team of people who were responsible for it. And I think that that gesture is symbolic of how most mainstream publications think about video games. Our core demographic is 21 to 45. They live in cities. They generally make more than $60,000 a year. But the big thing is that they're a cultural consumer. So we ask them, what other things do they do? So they play video games 5 to 12 hours a week. But their favorite network is HBO. They read The New Yorker and they read Wired. They buy a book once a month. They go see a movie once a month. If you didn't know that they were video game players, you would describe them as cultural elites. They are people who grew up on video games and now they have discretionary income and they think, oh, it's very natural for me to have an Xbox. In the same way that I have my movies and maybe I have some graphic novels and I have my books, I also have video games right next to it. There's no distinction there for them.
Is this why you have a problem with the word gamer?
I do. I think that the perception of who plays video games is changing a lot. And there are a lot of people who don't think of themselves as video game players who are. People play Farmville. Farmville is a Facebook game where you basically set up a farm and you buy in-game items. And
how many people play Farmville?
Over 200 million, something like that. It is incredibly popular. So if it's a 50-year-old mom in Kansas and she's playing Farmville 40, 50 hours a week, by any other description, those are hardcore gamers, but they don't think of themselves as gamers. So people who play Angry Birds, anybody who's played Angry Birds for hours and hours and hours, you are a gamer.
Jamin Brophy Warren is the editor of Killscreen magazine. Once I tried to play a massive multiplayer online game called EverQuest. I could have been an elf or a human or a troll, but I chose to enter that magic realm as a gnome named Kreplach. Kreplach took her maiden steps into EverQuest and fell down. And like the old lady in the commercial, I tried and tried, but couldn't get up. For all I know, Kreplach is still lying there. Novelist Nicholson Baker wrote in The New Yorker about his own journey into video games, when, in an effort to suss out his son's obsession, he plunged into the first-person shooter.
I thought the only way to make sense of it was to do the equivalent of taking a trip down the Nile. With the help of my son, I just came up with a list of 8 or 9 games that were the big releases. Call of Duty, Assassin's Creed. The first thing I learned was that video games are extremely difficult.
Did you learn how to play well enough to be able to understand what your son and his friends might be getting out of them?
Yes, I started to enjoy it, especially Call of Duty Modern Warfare 2, which was the biggest hit of last year. I got completely caught up in it and fascinated by the kind of odd political message that it had, or the cynicism, or maybe it was sincerity. I couldn't figure it out. But the main thing was that I died a lot, and every time I died, they gave me this aphorism from all sorts of people. Dick Cheney, Gandhi, Confucius, that was a good one. Before you embark on a journey of revenge, you must dig 2 graves. Well, there's a lot of truth in that. But it comes after you've died in this miserable firefight, and you're often exhausted because you've been through the same firefight, say, 7 or 8 times and failed. I think that outsiders underestimate the importance of learning how to fail at something very complicated over and over again and then finally make it.
It was towards the end of your experiment with video games that you played Heavy Rain, which you said was one of the most self-consciously artistic of the games on the list.
Yes. The script, 2,000 pages long, branching possibilities. You know what? As soon as you call something an art form, which obviously video games are, the people who are doing the thing kind of tense up, and they start thinking we're artists, so we should be arty. What does arty mean to people who aren't really having fun? It means it's a downer. And I don't know. I felt that Heavy Rain was a deeply unhappy experience. I mean, you watch your own son die in front of your eyes, and then you spend the rest of the time trying to save the life of your other son. And one way or another, you chop off bits of yourself and kill other people, and it's so hackneyed. Why can't things be funny and arty? Why can't they be maybe bloody, but bloody in a fresh way? Why do they have to be echoing cop shows that we all have seen from the 80s and 90s?
Novelist Nicholson Baker. Tom Bissell, author of Extra Lives, Why Video Games Matter, agrees that video games are least artful when they try to mimic other art forms. But as he told us earlier this year, when video game designers play to the strengths of the genre, violence can be a profound experience.
In Grand Theft Auto 4, they created this really tormented, kind of awful character named Nico.
During the war, we did some bad things. Bad things happen to us. Maybe that is no excuse. But I need money. This pays. And I'm good at it.
Nico is trying to escape his nature, and that's what the game is really about. Nico is fundamentally a bad guy. But he has a decent sense of right and wrong, and you sense that he kind of wants to do the right thing. Now, the problem is that the game actually asks him to do bad things throughout the entire game, and he does them with varying levels of enthusiasm. To me, the really riveting part of the game was rooting for him and trying to play it in a way that honored my conception of him, which was as a legitimately tormented person.
You're animating Nico.
You're both observing him and you're also portraying him, which is this really weird thing that video games do.
You make a point of saying, you know, that what books allow you to do is to inhabit the consciousness of another person. Is that getting better in today's games?
Well, no, and I don't think it really can. I really think if you work in a medium, your point is to bring out what the medium does best. As a fiction writer, what I seek to achieve is that sense that you, the reader, has entered into another human being who is suddenly a living person, and you are getting a guided tour of their mind. And that's the thing that only fiction can give you. All of the juice of video game storytelling comes from those moments in which, for instance, at the end of Grand Theft Auto, Nico has this run-in with someone who betrayed him. Nico's been looking for him the whole game. This man is like a pathetic, drug-addicted wretch, and Nico has the gun to his head, and suddenly the game gives control back to you, and you have to decide what to do with this guy. Do you walk away, or do you kill him? Your impulse is to show him mercy because you're a human being, but at the same time, you can't forget what Nico has sort of suffered because of this guy. That is the kind of storytelling that I love about games. It actually gives you this weird and often very troubling kind of agency, and fiction can't do that, movies can't do that. That's the kind of things that I love about games, is those moments of just jaw-dropping, scary freedom.
Writer Tom Bissell. Bissell says there's something inherent in the video game medium that creates a weird push and pull between the creator and the audience, and that sometimes they wrestle for meaning. And it doesn't leave you when you leave the game. Tetris slips behind your eyelids, raining rectangles, even as you try to sleep. It's called the Tetris effect. How might expecting rewards and penalties from every action change you? How might long hours pulling the strings of the conflicted Nico change you? How might those experiences shared by millions change the world? Some informed speculation up next. This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, we're rerunning the video game show we first aired over New Year's. A few minutes ago, you heard Tom Bissell describe his experience playing Grand Theft Auto, wrestling with the game creator for the soul of the character called Nico. But Bissell also described another game where the soul you're wrestling for is your own.
It's a game called Far Cry 2. It takes place in a contemporary African civil war. It's extremely beautiful. And yet, it is just the most unrelentingly savage game I think I've ever played. Most games that are violent give you the gun, push you in the direction of the bad guys, and say, hey, go kill all those guys. They're bad. You'll be rewarded. Good job. Far Cry 2 does something really confounding. Going through the game, quote, getting better at killing, the game kind of introduces slowly that you're actually not helping things, that in fact, you're kind of the problem. Everything you're doing is just making this conflict worse. So by the end of the game, you're just a wreck. You're progressing through the game because that's what the game's asking you to do, but it's also throwing all of this stuff back at you that's actually shaming you a little bit for being a participant in this virtual slaughter, and I love that about it.
Does it give you the option of, say, joining a UN peacekeeper force or a diplomatic delegation?
It absolutely does not. No, it doesn't.
Games are so expensive and the business so risk-averse, it's very hard to make a game like Far Cry 2. Clint Hocking was its creative director. Now he's creative director of LucasArts.
It's not like people jump at the chance for me to make a game that's sort of meaningfully about civil war in Africa. People aren't super excited about that, and it takes a lot of trust from the people that I'm working for, and I have to put up or shut up because it's a big risk.
2 years ago, Hocking made waves at the 2008 Game Developers Conference in San Francisco when in a speech he exhorted the assembled to stretch beyond the conventional shoot 'em up. He asked, why can't we make a game that means something? What was the game that inspired that heartfelt rhetorical question of yours?
I wasn't inspired from a game that did it. I was inspired from a game that failed to. I think the better bullet point from my rant there was to say, why isn't Call of Duty about duty, or why isn't Medal of Honor about honor? Medal of Honor is about mapping pixels over guys and pulling a trigger. It's not really about honor in any meaningful way, and I was frustrated by that. The Medal of Honor is a pretty prestigious and important thing that we value fairly highly, and it kind of trivializes it to make a game that's about just blowing away waves of faceless dudes, right?
Clint Hocking's Far Cry 2 is a game that does not trivialize, that puts the player in the thick of a complex scenario. Therein, says Ian Bogost, lies the real potential of the medium. Ian Bogost is a video game designer, critic, and author of the upcoming How to Do Things with Video Games. He says that because games can dispense with narrative and plunge you into a system, you can experience the unintended consequences of processes and policies. Games can teach us in ways that novels and journalism can't about how the real world works and doesn't work.
When you play a game, what you're really doing is enacting some role inside of a simulated world that has particular rules. We're not necessarily looking for a simple answer when we play, but rather to see the consequences of different approaches. Kind of coming to grips with that ambiguity in the world is something that we would do well to embrace. If you think about a traditional game, one that doesn't have anything to do with the computer, a game like Go or chess, what makes those games last for millennia is that you can't find the bottom of them. There's always something that doesn't get revealed that you have to defer into the next session. And as you experience more and more of the world as a system, then you realize, you know, there aren't really good answers ever. Instead, there are a complexity of interwoven perspectives, and I'm never going to get to the bottom of them. It sounds, you know, maybe nihilistic, but I don't mean it to. It's the sublimity of realizing there's just never going to be a simple solution.
Do you think this will result in a better world?
The optimal situation would be one in which we realize that we've been cheated, that we've been told these simple versions of what's really going on in the world for years, for decades, and we will no longer accept it. We will always want the more complicated story. That's what I think has the potential to change the world.
Bogost is interested in what he calls persuasive games, games that by their rules, their systems, their unintended consequences, can increase the understanding of people and policies and by design advocate for positive change. But beware, because as games draw many of us into the worlds of their creators, games also increasingly intrude into our own worlds. Last February, at the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences annual DICE Summit in Las Vegas, Carnegie Mellon professor and CEO of Shell Games, Jesse Shell, painted a picture of the future.
And what will that world be like? Well, I think it'll be like this. You'll get up in the morning to brush your teeth. And the toothbrush can sense that you're brushing your teeth. And so, hey, good job for you. 10 points for brushing your teeth. And it can measure how long, and you're supposed to brush them for 3 minutes, and you did. And so you get a bonus for that. Hey, you brushed your teeth every day this week, another bonus. And right, and who cares? The toothpaste company, the toothbrush company, the more you brush, the more toothpaste you use, they have a vested financial interest. So then you go and you get on the bus. The bus? Why am I taking the bus? You're taking the bus because the government has started giving out all kinds of bonus points to people who use public transportation. And you can use these points for tax incentives. And you get to work on time, good job. You get a special bonus. So then you go to lunch and you've had Dr. Peppers all week. And so you know you got to have another Dr. Pepper because you got 10 points, 10 points, 10 points, 10 points. And then you have another one. You know there's a special with Dr. Pepper this week. If you have 5 Dr. Peppers in a week, 500 bonus points. So you're definitely going to take advantage of that. And then you got a meeting at another building. It's a half a mile away. And you could take the shuttle over, but you decide, I'm going to walk because the health insurance plan that you're on gives you bonus points if you walk like more than a mile each day. And we can sense that easily, you know, through your digital shoes. And if you get your heart rate up about a certain amount, then you get more bonus points from your health insurance company. So then you're going shopping on the way home. And man, this is like a place you can get a lot of points. And it's really complicated. So you let your app figure it out. It like looks at all the point systems you have. It looks at what you want. And then it tells you which ones to buy in order to get, ooh, wow, a lot of points just because I make good choices shopping. And then you get home and your daughter's like, oh, I got my report card. And you're like, oh, good job. You're getting 2,000 points from the state for getting such good grades. And you're getting 5,000 as a parent from the Obama bonus for the good parenting bonus, which you're excited because you can use that as tax relief. And then you say, hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. Did you practice your piano? And she's like, yeah, I practiced my piano. Well, what score did you get? He's like, oh, well, I got 150,000. 150,000, that's the best you've ever had on that particular sonata. That's 9,000 points given by the Arts Council for your scholarship fund. So go you, right? And then you go and watch television And like, I don't even want to talk about this. It's just points, 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 points. Because there's eye sensors, right, that can tell when you're watching the ads, certain ads especially, because you're going to get points for them. And your remote has a little screen on it and with a little camera, so you can kind of be live chat with other people you know are watching the show. And you play all these games and you get all these points while you watch television. That'll be very natural. And you get to thinking about how, wow, is it possible maybe that since all this stuff is being watched and measured and judged, that maybe I should change my behavior a little bit and be a little better than I would have been? And so it could be that these systems are just all crass commercialization and it's terrible, but it's possible that they'll inspire us to be better people if the game systems are designed right. Anyway, I'm not sure about all that, but I do know this stuff is coming. Man, it's got to come. What's going to stop it?
This week, I asked Jesse Schell how he felt about all that. Is this a future that you look forward to, where there is a potential distraction around every corner, a lot of which are just ads?
I certainly don't look forward to all of it. There's going to be a lot of parts of this that are going to seem quite devilish because so many people are going to be competing for our attention. I often think of it this way. The 21st century is going to be a war on the attention of humanity. Where a civilization focuses its attention, I mean, that's what defines what the civilization cares about.
Way to shift the responsibility, Shell. You're saying that the games that consume a quarter of America's entertainment dollar, yet a big chunk of the population would never consider playing, will define what our civilization cares about? Well, that doesn't bode well unless you actually believe that being a druid wandering around in World of Warcraft 20 hours a week can actually make you a better person. And who could possibly believe that?
I'm Jane McGonigal. I'm a game designer. I've been making games online now for 10 years, and my goal for the next decade is to try to make it as easy to save the world in real life as it is to save the world in online games.
That's Jane McGonigal at this year's TED Conference in Long Beach, California.
Right now, we spend 3 billion hours a week playing online games. Some of you might be thinking, that's a lot of time to spend playing games, maybe too much time, considering how many urgent problems we have to solve in the real world. But actually, according to my research at the Institute for the Future, actually the opposite is true. 3 billion hours a week is not nearly enough gameplay to solve the world's most urgent problems. In fact, if we want to solve problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, global conflict, obesity, I believe that we need to aspire to play games online for at least 21 billion hours a week by the end of the next decade. No, I'm serious. I am. Here's why.
She showed the audience a photograph of the face of a gamer gaming and described what she saw written on that face.
The sense of urgency, a little bit of fear, but intense concentration. The crinkle of the eyes up and around the mouth is a sign of optimism. And the eyebrows up is surprise. This is a gamer who's on the verge of something called an epic win. Now, oh, you've heard of that. Okay, good. So an epic win is an outcome that is so extraordinarily positive, you had no idea it was even possible until you achieved it. And when you get there, you are shocked to discover what you're truly capable of. And this is the face that we need to see on millions of problem solvers all over the world as we try to tackle the obstacles of the next century. When we're in game worlds, I believe that many of us become the best version of ourselves, the most likely to stick with a problem as long as it takes to get up after failure and try again. In real life, when we face failure, when we confront obstacles, we often don't feel that way. We feel anxious, maybe depressed, frustrated, or cynical. We never have those feelings when we're playing games. Whenever you show up in one of these online games, especially in World of Warcraft, there are lots and lots of different characters who are willing to trust you with a world-saving mission. Right away. But not just any mission. It's a mission that is perfectly matched with your current level in the game. But it is on the verge of what you're capable of, so you have to try hard. There's no unemployment in World of Warcraft. There's always something specific and important to be done. And there are also tons of collaborators ready to work with you to achieve your epic mission. Now, the problem with collaborative online environments like World of Warcraft, it's so satisfying, we decide to spend all our time in these game worlds. So far, collectively, all the World of Warcraft gamers have spent 5.93 million years solving the virtual problems of Azeroth. Now, to put that in context, 5.93 million years ago was when our earliest primate human ancestors stood up. So when we talk about how much time we're currently investing in playing games, the only way it makes sense is to talk about time at the magnitude of human evolution, which is an extraordinary thing, but it's also apt, because it turns out that by spending all this time playing games, we're actually changing what we are capable of as human beings. We're evolving to be a more collaborative and hardy species. This is true, I believe this. So consider this really interesting statistic. It was recently published by a researcher at Carnegie Mellon University. The average young person today in a country with a strong gamer culture will have spent 10,000 hours playing online games by the age of 21. For children in the United States, 10,080 hours is the exact amount of time you will spend in school from fifth grade to high school graduation if you have perfect attendance. So we have an entire parallel track of education going on where young people are learning as much about what it takes to be a good gamer as they're learning about everything else in school. So the big question is, what exactly are gamers getting so good at? Because if we could figure that out, we would have a virtually unprecedented human resource on our hands.
She had pondered that question long and hard and had come up with at least four potentially world-saving characteristics of hardcore gamers.
The first is urgent optimism. Urgent optimism is the desire to act immediately to tackle an obstacle combined with the belief that we have a reasonable hope of success. Gamers always believe that an epic win is possible and that it's always worth trying, and trying now. Okay, gamers are virtuosos at weaving a tight social fabric. There's a lot of interesting research that shows that we like people better after we play a game with them, even if they've beaten us badly. And the reason is it takes a lot of trust to play a game with someone. We trust that they will spend their time with us, that they will play by the same rules, value the same goal, they'll stay with the game until it's over. And so playing a game together actually builds up bonds and trust and cooperation and builds stronger social relationships as a result. Blissful productivity. I love it. You know, there's a reason why the average World of Warcraft gamer plays for 22 hours a week. It's because we know, when we're playing a game, that we're actually happier working hard than we are relaxing. And gamers are willing to work hard all the time if they're given the right work. Finally, epic meaning. Gamers love to be attached to awe-inspiring missions. They have compiled more information about World of Warcraft on the internet than any other topic covered on any other wiki in the world. They are building an epic knowledge resource about the World of Warcraft. Okay, so these are four superpowers that add up to one thing. Gamers believe that they are individually capable of changing the world. And the only problem is they believe that they are capable of changing virtual worlds and not the real world. That's the problem that I'm trying to solve. We did a game called Superstruct at the Institute for the Future, and the premise was a supercomputer has calculated that humans have only 23 years left on the planet. You know Jerry Bruckheimer movies? You form a dream team, you've got the astronaut, the scientist, the ex-convict, and they all have something to do to save the world. But in our game, instead of just having five people on the dream team, we said everybody's on the dream team, and it's your job to invent the future of energy, the future of food, the future of health, the future of security, and the future of the social safety net. We had 8,000 people play that game for 8 weeks. They came up with 500 insanely creative solutions that you can go online if you Google Superstruct and see. So I'm going to wrap up now. I want to ask a question. What do you think happens next? We have all these amazing superpowers, blissful productivity, the ability to weave a tight social fabric, this feeling of urgent optimism and the desire for epic meaning. When I look forward to the next decade, I know two things for sure: that we can make any future we can imagine, and we can play any games we want. So I say, let the world-changing games begin. Thank you.
You can link to McGonagall's and Jesse Schell's unedited talks from our website on themedia.org. Meanwhile, on this New Year's weekend, you could embrace the future, because you can't stop it. Consider the words of Nicholson Baker. Outsiders underestimate the importance of learning how to fail at something very complicated over and over again, and then finally make it. The very essence of gaming. And civilization.
And while people like to hate, discriminate, and be mean, in my world we work together to defeat the Lich King.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Bolo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, and PJ Vogt, with more help and much gratitude to departing intern Nerida Brownlee, and edited by me. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keefe, with help from Rob Granis. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
Even addicted. Say my habits are bad, my silly life is conflicted. But if it makes me happy, why should I quit this? The world brings me down.
Wow, support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.